among the rain and light, I saw the figure five in gold on a red fire truck, moving tent unheeded.
Hi, I'm Harvey DeRue in conversation with Chris Ludwig and Cliff Ridley on their new three-album recording of 56 art songs based on poems of William Carlos Williams, the most eminent of the American modernist poets. I thought we could start with each of us saying a brief word about ourselves and then launch into a discussion about this exciting project. I was a professor of English at Simon Fraser University for over 30 years, where I specialized in Old and Middle English language and literature, and Old Norse language and literature. For 3 years, I was also the editor of West Coast Review. Since retirement, I've taught opera appreciation and the history of opera in the SFU Seniors Program and was founding secretary of City Opera Vancouver for 5 years. Chris?
Yeah, I'm a Canadian composer, and I'm an associate composer of the Canadian Music Center. I began as a flute player, as a woodwind player, and initially started composing for winds, and gradually became enamored with art song writing, and have written a great deal of art song over the years. The William Carlos Williams series is actually my second series of recordings of art song that I have composed.
Yeah, I'm Cliff Ridley, and I'm the singer in this project, and I had the good fortune of working with Chris on a previous setting to music of another poet, a more local poet, and we've been very stimulated with our recent project with Williams. I pretty much sung all my life. I've always felt a little bit of a split in my aspirations between the career that I make money at, which is a psychologist and psychoanalyst, and the career which I don't make money at, the singing. And I've recorded a few other albums, one in German lead and another of two Canadian composers, two women composers of the 20th century, Jean Coulthard and Violet Archer.
All right, well, we'll begin with our first question then, and this is addressed to both of you. Perhaps you could have a go at it first, Chris. Back in the 18th to early 20th centuries, when art songs were in their heyday, they were part of mainstream music, what we today call classical. Song still belongs to the mainstream, but that has been taken over by pop music, Tin Pan Alley, rock, rap, and hip-hop, and so on. So why art song in the 21st century? Is there really an audience for it anymore?
I think once people discover it, there sure is an audience for it. Most popular music these days is limited to a very small palette of emotions, really. Concept of love, fame, money, success, and that's about it. Whereas art song deals with the whole range of human emotions and human experiences. And to say that the average human being only has love and anger and hate and lust would be a disservice to the human experience, really. You know, you say art song came out of the 19th century, which is certainly true. The people who lived in the 19th century had the same palette of emotions that we do today. If anything, I find the emotional palette today to be more scattered. We seem to think that we are more emotionally evolved than people hundreds of years ago, but that simply isn't the case. Perhaps technology has confused that a fair amount. And that's why I think art song, being an acoustic art form, strips away all that technological confusion that surrounds human communication. And there is something very human and genuine about being at an art song concert where you have a singer standing in front of you. You can connect with that person on not just a visual level, but almost on a personal level, because it's one person speaking to you, not just the noise of the general day-to-day and the noise of, you know, our big, a big complex society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As a singer, I relate to this question on a few levels. I mean, on a straight, shall I say, narcissistic level, the desire to kind of get up in front of an audience and perform. Sometimes it feels it would be great if at Recitals for Art Slam, there'd be a larger audience. Often there isn't. It's a smaller, more intimate audience, which in fact, as Chris points out, that's probably been the tradition. It started in really a living room kind of venue in the 19th century and in the 18th, 19th century. So that's part of it. But I think part of it as a singer is just the desire to sing art song. I bet you if you survey people who are into art song as performers, they would certainly say they do it because they enjoy it. You know, it takes a long time to prepare these songs, and unless you really enjoy it, unless you enjoy being in a room and singing to the walls, you know, maybe for months at a time while you're learning this stuff, it would be hard to persist. So I really enjoy the experience of singing. You really enjoy the experience of singing good poetry. And I've been fortunate with this project in being able to do that.
But it takes a long time for a singer to become truly comfortable with contemporary art song and the deeper meanings of the connection between poetry mm-hmm. and music. Mm-hmm. It's something that a university student certainly can struggle with. You know, there's very often many times where a university student singing German art song may not even know the meaning of the words. There's many examples yeah. of that where they don't look up the translation. So yeah. it takes maturity to really be able to wrap your head around the poetry.
Yeah, I suppose part of it's maturity. I think for myself, for whatever reason, I just felt really attracted to this form of performance and art. I've also done a little bit of opera and musical theater and, you know, various things. But there was something about the art song that really was satisfying for me on multiple levels. And certainly I've matured with it over the years. But really, I started to sing this literature in my late teens, early 20s, and went to study with Francis James Adaskin in Victoria, one of the pioneers of art song performance in Canada. Brought a lot of this music to Canada, and premier performances and whatnot. So it was just really stimulating for me. And perhaps my career too as a psychologist and psychoanalyst, I'm really attuned to the perhaps the depth of interpretation, to the depth of human experience, and good poetry addresses these things, as does the good music that goes with it.
Yeah. Well, you're speaking very much about yourself as the artist and mm-hmm. what you value in it. The question is really about the audience. If art song has the qualities you guys claim for it, and if, as Chris says, other types of song out there today are very limited in their emotional spectrum, why is the audience for art song so small compared to the audience for this other type of material? Mm-hmm. Why do you guys think that is the case?
I hate to say that other forms of song is necessarily limited. I'm sure that people who are into other forms of popular song find that for them it speaks to them and they feel different experiences or different affects.
You know, what kind of comes to mind is when Handel was writing Opera Seria in England, and all of of a sudden people stopped going and being interested in opera seria because it was all in Italian.
Yeah.
And once the Beggar's Opera by John Gay came in, everyone started going to that because it was cheaper and it was in the vernacular.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of art song is in foreign languages. Mm-hmm. And that by, just from a pure practical point of view, is difficult for people to get their heads around.
Certainly the opera has become more popular and get greater audiences now. They show the English translations, you know, along with the opera. But in general, music is very attuned, the popular music, what is listened to is very attuned to the culture of the time. And I think what Harvey is getting at for me is art song, is there a place for art song in the culture of our time? And I think there is, and particularly, it's an intimate kind of venue. It's one that you need to really be able to relax with, be able to draw up associations within yourself to be able to reflect on. There's a certain contemplative aspect. And I think the fact that people now have the means to sit down with their iPods or their computer to put on the headphones and at the flick of a button call up the music they enjoy and able to take that with them throughout the day. Even there's opportunity here, I think, to draw people to this venue, but at this point it I think it's limited in terms of the draw, but I think there's some potential for people to add on to their usual listening experience this kind of way of artistic expression.
Contemporary art song has two strikes against it. Mm-hmm. One strike is the fact that everyone has a preconceived notion these days as to what new avant-garde contemporary music in the classical area has, that strange noises and you know, artistically decadent and irrelevant and idiosyncratic. Mm-hmm. So you have that preconception, and then you add art song, which is, you know, I guess a lot of people might think is, you know, a stuffy kind of operatic kind of art form.
Yeah.
Well, art song, as we know, is a hybrid art form. You have words and music combined. And I'm curious to know what you think each of those elements contributes to the art form. What is their effect on each other, and what kind of hybrid results from bringing words and music together?
I find I really relate to these questions starting on a personal level. I really feel that it starts with the poetry, it starts with the words, and that if you have a really good poem and one that is has the potential to be set well to music, that the music already is in the poetry. I mean, poetry goes hand in hand with music. I feel if you give an art song recital, there's an aspect of doing a poetry reading. And you get up there and you communicate with your audience and you tell them about this, what this poem is saying in a way. I mean, you deliver it in a way that they can take in. I do find with art song that it is helpful in recital to set the stage for people, so maybe have a little bit of a short talk beforehand, not meant to be boring, but just help to get the mental set of the thing. And I find that even people who haven't listened to art song before find that really helpful in getting into it. I've had young people come up to me after recital and say, "Oh wow, yeah, that's the first time I've been to an art song recital," and obviously, you know, they enjoyed it, and you can see the wheels ticking in their mind. Oh well, yeah, I can see maybe listening to a little bit of this.
What do you think the music is adding to what you're giving?
Well, I think the music, that's the tricky thing. Okay, for me as a singer, and what I would look in working with a composer around contemporary art song, is a composer who could approach the poem in a way that would bring interesting, even exciting music to it but not get in the way of the inherent music that's already in the poem, and hopefully enhance that. It's not always perfect, but I think an art song composer, I really think it's a talent. It's like an inborn talent. There are certain composers who can do it, and other very, very good composers in other forms of music can't. You need to be able to hear the poem, to hear the music in the words, and then also bring what you have to offer to it. I've been fortunate because my experience in working with Chris is when I perform his music, his songs, that a large proportion of the time I feel very good about it. I mean, there's an odd little thing that comes up, but you know, we're talking about 56 songs in this current endeavor. And it's been exciting, and each one has been an adventure. And even though I might have looked at that poem and thought maybe the music a little different or something, each time I tried to immerse myself in what Chris brought to it musically, and I've always come through that journey at the end of it feeling, hey, this is kind of an interesting take. I really enjoy doing this music with this poem.
And so it's a process of enhancement.
Yeah, I think it's a process of enhancement. But for me, it's beyond that. You don't produce a lot of this stuff, like, you know, 56 songs, one composer, one composer, one poet. As a singer, you don't remain with a composer unless he's someone that you build up a relationship with and you trust as a composer, and that you're willing to go along to see if it works. If you come in as a singer of, you know, this is me and this is the way I conceive of it and whatnot, and I think you really have to fit with the composer. Mm-hmm. And it has to work for you, and I'm hoping it works for our audience out there. I mean, there's no guarantee of that, so we take a risk, you know. We produce the stuff and we put it out there, but I think our pairing has worked.
Well, Chris, what is it that your music does for the words? How do you marry the two into this art form called art song?
I let the words dominate my process. Before I actually start writing music, I will speak and read the poem many times to myself to get the sense of the rhythm of the words so that I'm not fighting the words. And I think when you fight the words, you disrespect them. But at the same time, I want the experience of writing for myself to be organic and not forced. When I set words, I actually don't write the melody by itself first. Mm-hmm. What I do is I write the piano part and the melody simultaneously, mm-hmm. bar by bar, which is perhaps a bit of a different process. And sometimes I even write the piano part first, and then I use the subject material of the piano part to work with the words, which is perhaps a very different way of approaching it. But by writing piano and voice together simultaneously, it allows those two parts to really mesh. I've always taken the approach that the piano part is as important as the words, if not sometimes even more. Sometimes the voice has the central element of expression, where sometimes the piano is the centerpiece of expression. And that's something you had mentioned in terms of hybrid art form. In essence, piano and singer is a hybrid element. You have one that's a physical instrument, and then you have another which is a human being, an organic, entity. And they're very different, but something that I think was discovered back in the time of Schubert is that this combination is the most unified in terms of expressing poetry. And there's a reason why piano and singer became the standard for art song. It's not by accident. And I find that if you add elements outside of piano and singer, you add another instrument, that suddenly that unity can be blown apart. It doesn't work a lot of the times.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, if I listen to, say, singer and organ, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily hear that as art song,
right?
Or even guitar and singer.
That's it, because I hadn't thought of that, but that's because the art really did evolve with a singer and piano, didn't it? Right from the beginning, yeah. I often wondered why. I was thinking, well, why couldn't there be other instruments? Why are we locked into this singer and piano? And I've even heard it be criticized. You know, there's no longer a place for this form of the, you know, singer standing in the crook of the grand piano. You know, that's I mean, back to the other question. But there is an interplay and an intimacy that develops between piano and singer. And
well, I suppose the other thing is maybe every composer played piano, so that it was natural to accompany singers with piano.
But. Yeah. I haven't had a lot of experience with other instruments, but I did it. We did add flute to a piece that we did, a Violet Archer piece on a previous recording, which worked well. But I have limited experience.
Well, flute and clarinet are the typical pairings that I hear.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't necessarily hear a tuba added to art song. I suppose you could.
Yeah.
But you don't want to add an instrument just for the sake of getting attention.
Yeah.
You know, it should complement.
Yeah.
You know, flute is a wonderful instrument at complementing an art song. But I like to think that if you add more than one instrument, it is no longer art song, it's chamber music.
Interesting. Okay.
It's a different art form.
It's a different art form.
Is that how you would characterize orchestral arts, or Mahler's cycles, for example, with orchestra as chamber music as opposed to art song?
I see them as being certainly there's a bit of a confusion in this one. We see those as song cycles. But a song cycle can also be a group of poems, multi-poems. In essence, the William Carlos Williams is a large-scale song cycle, 56 songs that all go together. But when I see Mahler, I think of something that's along the lines of the Beethoven tradition, that is the choral symphony. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a huge grand form, whereas art song is a very small, intimate form. So they're completely, on different ends of the spectrum.
Well, this question is for Chris. You've answered this to a degree, but what do you think a composer should strive for in setting words to music? Are there general rules that make for good word setting, or does each piece make its own demands and you really can't generalize about the process?
Certainly art song has a lot of conventions for a composer. Composers setting art songs, you know, for the last 200 years typically have a piano introduction, we call it a piano prelude, and then we have, you know, a stanza or two that are sung, and then we have a piano interlude, which is piano by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, this goes on, and it could be several interludes. They may be the same each time. It could be the same music over and over again. And that's very common in Schubert. Yeah. Strophic art songs, very common. And then it'll end with a piano, what we call postlude.
Mm-hmm.
That's the traditional form. Mm-hmm. So the three traditional forms would be strophic, modified strophic, and modified strophic is where you can have some repetition of the music and then some that's different, and then you can have through composed where there's really relatively little. But that doesn't always work successfully with William Carlos Williams because his stanzas are very unequal. It has a strong narrative quality. So you, as a composer, have to conceive of things a bit differently. Not just in terms of the rhythm and the phrasing, but how you find consistency, how you don't have it as sort of a wandering of musical motive, musical idea, continuous spinning, you know, of ideas. Mm-hmm. I think mature composer will use less material. They will use less ideas and develop those ideas. Whereas the beginning composer tends to throw the entire kit and caboodle into their composition. And so by narrowing your choices down, I think you can be more effective.
Yeah.
And so that's why there's certainly times where you may have the singer sing a particular melody, and then that melody is repeated exactly with a different set of words, or very close.
Mm-hmm.
That can work very effectively.
Yeah. I thought in general, you made wonderful compromises with that over the songs between some repetition? I mean, you worked in some themes, well, particularly, say, in Yachts, which is written in a more formal way, where the melodies were repeated to a degree, always with little differences, which bugs the heck out of singers, but when a couple of notes are changed in essentially the same melody. But with others, there was repetition of musical motives, or even a repetition of a word, like at the end of the song, a kind of reflecting back on something in the poem, I think, that spoke to you or that was still resonating in your mind. And you would refer back to that at the end of the song. So I think you used a variety of musical techniques to get a sense of continuity through this, through composition, over long poems too, which is bloody miraculous if you ask me, actually, because, you know, some of these poems are really long, and
Romance Modern, and you brought a lot to it,
but there was a sense of continuity.
It isn't necessarily that repetition is overt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to put it in a listener's face.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to pound it out.
Right.
It can be in the piano part with, say, recurring harmonies and colors. Those subconsciously will give the listener a sense that it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important, that there's some sort of structure and craft put into the piece.
Right.
There has to be some thought put into it, not just sort of a random spewing of material.
Comes to mind, what a couple of songs I really, really enjoyed with the way you used a musical technique to kind of tie it together and really bring in yourself musically in a more extended way was, they're small songs, First Praise is one of them, Hick Jacket is the other that I'm thinking of, and you had this nice little theme, like in First Praise, there's this, the young college girl, she's walking down the street, and you just developed this nice little musical phrase, you brought her to life. And then I sang, and then in the middle you brought this phrase back again, and sometimes you vary the something in the phrase, or you vary the tempo or something. But again, it really tied the song together. Hick Jacket and the coroner's little children, that theme also sticks in my mind. And there you did very clearly changed the tempo. It was slower in the second part. And
I don't think the piano player liked that piece very much.
Oh, really? Oh, well, it worked. I can't remember that she did.
It was Tatiana,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
She was saying she didn't get it.
Yeah. Well, I think at sometimes the pianists, as we worked over the songs, would say, you know, what is this? And I think, okay, let's just stick with it. Because I've worked so much with you. I know that, have faith, let's stick with it.
Well, that piece is pretty bombastic, so it sort of pounds away, and she was sort of questioning the madness of it, right?
I tell you, very often at the end, they would end up loving the song, so it was interesting, I think, how you were able to bring in these musical ideas, and even in some, you know, slightly extended form, which really lent themselves to myself being able to communicate the song when I was singing. And even when it, you know, I mean, often the piano was maybe the main feature of the song. But myself as a singer, in my singer narcissism, you know, the voice part of my body, it's me. I didn't feel threatened. I felt really good about that. And well, if you work as an art song performer, of course it is about a duet between the piano and the voice, and it's all about that. But there are times with your music where the piano was, you know, sometimes the main feature.
I wouldn't say I'm always serious about it, though.
Yeah.
I think sometimes I have a rather strange sense of humor as far as piano writing goes and the vocal writing. And I remember when I was at university as a composition student, I had written this piano piece, which was rather ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it was really quite funny. And it was being performed at a seminar, and one of the professors asked, well, why did you write that? You know, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I thought it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And his reply was, well, it's not funny to me.
The ultimate test is, I think, is it funny for your audience, and at least as a performer, and, do these things work? And it's all about taking chances, it really is. And I think a lot of stuff we've done, we have taken chances, and yeah, who knows?
Well, certainly ones like Great Mullen, I wouldn't say conservative pieces by any means.
No, but Williams was not conservative. It's amazing. This stuff was written like sometimes 100 years ago, right? I mean, his first published book of poems where Williams actually made that transition from some of the early experimental, a little bit of romantic stuff he got caught in, but the first transition really into the true Williams and expression of himself in a modern form was The Tempers, which is 100 years ago. It was published in 1913. And a lot of the songs that we've done was taken from Sour Grapes, which was 1921. You know,
some of them are very risque, almost bordering on pornography.
Yeah, I mean, they're
really
amazing.
I mean, imagine at the time.
It sounds very contemporary, a lot of this stuff.
But a lot of it is covered up with, you know, images of flowers and nature. Yeah. When in fact, underneath that flowers and nature imagery is some pretty raunchy stuff.
Yeah.
But I think maybe he took that particular kind of language and approach to poetry so he wouldn't get into too much trouble, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to bring us back to something technical once again, being the pedant that I am. One thing that interests me particularly, because I'm interested in translation from one language to another, and in a way, creating a song out of a poem, as I see it, is a kind of translation. Maybe you don't see it that way. But I'm curious, when you create a song from a pre-existing poem, what your sense is of your obligation to the text of a poem, how, in what ways you are obliged to it, and what ways you feel that you're free to depart from it. As I recall, in the parable of the blind, you insert part of self-portrait into that. And there's a severe truncation of complaint from 22 lines to 2 lines. And I'm just curious to know what you see as the relation between the text of the poem you're setting and the song that you are creating.
As a composer, if the poem is lackluster or not strong, your piece, no matter how good it is, no matter how much effort you put into it, it's not going to come across as a good piece. Similarly, if the poem is brilliant, it will often compensate for a half-hearted effort as a composer, but that is to dishonor the poem. I think you have to, every time, put your best into it. Now, you're talking about Complaint, where I truncated the entire poem into 2 lines. I liked the ethereal nature of just those 2 lines. I said, you know, they call me and I go, which I repeat twice in that poem.
It is a frozen road. They call me and I go. Yeah. It is a frozen road. Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that in itself was a scene in itself. I don't think much more was needed to be said. You know, so maybe deviating from William Carlos Williams, but I mean, I can certainly, from my point of view, there is no one interpretation of Paul.
And but there, the obligation is to your song more than to the poem. I mean, is that fair enough to say? And that's not an accusation of any kind, but do you sometimes say, my song is what I've got to be true to, never mind the poem?
I think it's a matter of making the two fit. You don't want the music to fight the poetry. Mm-hmm. And if you fight the poetry as a composer, you're going to lose every time.
Of all 56 songs, that's the only one you did that. That's the only time you did that.
Yes.
All the other songs, all the other 55 songs you composed them. And when Chris composed those 2 lines, I was a bit startled, because I remember Williams way back, you know, in my 20s. I remember doing my internship, and it was in Maine, actually, in a poor area of Maine, and it covered 3 counties, and I'd be off in these little mental health centers off in these sort of backwoods areas, and really interesting work I really loved. And the 2 lines that always resonated in my mind of Williams was, "They call me and I go. It is a frozen road." And okay, so as a psychologist, there's some experience, you know, doing that professionally. As a physician, it's huge, and particularly the physician that Williams was. He delivered babies, you know, in the middle of the night, someone calls. And, and that whole poem, by the way, Complaint, is a beautiful poem. As he goes and delivers the baby and finds the woman in bed.
Has to get out in the middle of the winter and trudge out.
It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous poem. But nevertheless, those two lines stuck in my... And Chris did not know that.
That's
he did not know that.
Fascinating.
It is.
Actually, that's the first time I've heard it.
Yeah.
You telling,
I never told you that before.
No.
But I was startled. Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't mind talking about ninth poem again, of the pictures from Bruegel's cycle again. Parallel of the Blind.
Right, so, leading the
Yeah, that's an interesting event in that cycle. The very first movement, Self-Portrait, I took an Eric Satie chorale as the piano prelude, and I altered it to meet my own sense of aesthetic, so I liked it. And then I used that as the introduction. Well, what ended up happening is at the end of the cycle, which is Parable of the Blind, I started with the same chorale again, but I transposed it actually just for fun. But the music is identical to Self-Portrait, because I wanted, for the sake of unity, to bring back the first poem, the music and melody of the first poem, to the last poem. And that's why I end up repeating Crowded on the Canvas, which is from Self-Portrait.
And it really worked,
And, you know, so I kind of stumbled into it. And as I was rumbling along, it was sort of a spontaneous decision, but I was happy with
it. When I first looked at it, I thought, he photocopied the pages wrong. I was on the phone to you saying, "Chris, you got the pages wrong here, didn't you?" And he didn't say much. He just kind of chuckled. And he never fills me in. He lets me kind of discover these things myself and work it through somehow. Yeah. Well, it's kind of an interesting way, because that cycle actually includes also at the end the three poems about the children. But the first part of the cycle is looking at the Bruegel painting really more with adult subjects and that. And then that tacking on of the three things at the end of the children. But when you brought in...
But those are still painted based on...
They're still painting, so it's all one cycle. But when you brought in that repeat, it was after number 9, I believe, right? And,
yes.
And so it made a nice sort of semi-ending to that first little bit.
Yes.
And then... The three children ones also worked as part of the cycle, but also as part of a little thing unto themselves as well.
Yes. So and then you have the one that doesn't quite belong, but yet it does, the dance, which is the fugue.
The fugue, which is a fun song called The Dance. Williams actually composed that poem 18 years before he did the Bruegel cycle. The Bruegel cycle was done right at the end of his life. It was done when he'd had, you know, heart attack and strokes, and, you know, it was really quite an accomplishment. And that book, of course, received the Pulitzer Prize, which I don't know, but I'm wondering, too, I mean, not only on the strength of that book, but probably, I'm sure the committee looked at the output of this wonderful American writer and all the stuff he's produced. And, you know, unfortunately it happened
after he had
died. But it is miraculous what he produced towards the end of his life, even with this these physical disabilities coming on.
Well, Picture from Bruegel were on the last of the three albums. And on the same album, we included The Dance. As you say,
I think it starts the album. I think The Dance happens, and then there is one other song, and then into the Bruegel cycle.
Yes.
Your father, who did the sound engineering on this, was helpful in helping to arrange things and stuff. He probably had some input on that, but Frank's been a big part of this project, his father, who also, I mean, it relates to you in some ways, maybe your comment about popular genre, but Frank was an ex... rock musician, was in a prominent band in Vancouver and toured, and but now is a retired teacher and sound engineer, and did a wonderful job with putting together the stuff.
Well, choosing the order was also a colossal undertaking, too. Yeah. I mean, it's 56 songs, making them work from from a, even just a listening point of view is challenging.
And he had great comments. And I mean, this is someone who had, you know, a background in the whole popular genre, huge background in that.
The only one Frank and I couldn't agree on was The Rewaking.
Mm-hmm.
And again, The Rewaking is the last poem
that
Williams ever wrote.
Yeah.
And he wanted the beginning. And I just wanted nothing to do with that. I wanted it at the end.
Yes, I definitely wanted that then, because that was the last poem. And sooner or later, we come to the end of striving. Just had to be the last poem.
Establish the image of the rose, but not yet. You say extending the time indefinitely. Until a whole spring. Rekindle the violet to the fairy lady's slipper. And so by your love, the very sun itself is revived. Sooner or later, we must come to the end of striving. Establish the image of the